I'm going to dial 600 people a day. I'm going to send out 200 texts a day, and I'm going to make 5 offers a day every day for the next 90 days. Set that as a goal. Set those as your metrics. That's exactly what I would track. And I guarantee you, by the way, if you do that and you do that consistently for 90 freaking days, you will have success.
Mic check.
I'm good.
Mic check. Mic check.
You can read about success all day long, but if you don't put in the work, the mindset, execution, and the hustle behind your vision, it just remains a dream.
When everything goes wrong, you have to take all the responsibility.
We uncover what high-level entrepreneurs, business owners do to rise up from hustling daily.
So do what you feel passionate about. Take chances.
The world becomes your library to help you to become better at your craft.
Join me as I share with you actionable tips to help you grow your business, learn skills, and help you level up in your self-development journey.
Your number one spot for business and personal growth is the Online Hustlers Podcast with your host, Esteban Andrade. Every day I'm hustling.
Hey, what's going on, everyone that is in Online Hustlers Podcast? Today we have a special episode because this is the 2.0 version of the Online Hustlers Podcast for real estate investors, and entrepreneurs, wholesalers. Anyone that is actually listening to these episodes, we will get a lot of value from the guests that we have. And today is the first one that we do in-house, in person. So this specific guest has scaled his company and operated his company $7 million a year and still doing that. It also is getting into a few great ventures by combining now the education within the English and speaking community. So today we have Willie Numbers, and they call you Willie Numbers. I actually have no idea why they call you Willie Numbers. I'd love to actually know why.
Yeah, so my background's in finance. So I went to school, graduated, and I worked at Merrill Lynch for a while in New York. So I was in commodities. So hence Willie Numbers. And then Max Maxwell, actually years ago, a good friend of mine, he started calling me Willie Numbers because I was really good with numbers. And from there, he just, dude, this is a great nickname. You should take it. So,
Max Maxwell, how'd you get to meet him?
Dude, it was an Instagram DM. It's probably 4.5 years ago now when Max, I think he might have like 6,000 followers or something. And he posted a video of him driving for dollars using Land Glide, which I still use to this day. And I kind of sent him a DM on it. And we started chatting back and forth. And then one thing led to another. We got on a phone call one day. We hit it off and we started talking, and then it was my birthday the next year, and he actually flew down. We met for the first time. He came to my birthday dinner, and then, you know, I spoke at one of his events, the We Live events, and then over the years, we're part of the same mastermind too. So,
man, he's an awesome guy. But today I'd love to talk about more about that history behind everything. Yeah. It seems like you started some quiet time ago.
Yeah, 2017.
All right. Mm-hmm. So at that time, was it pretty popular wholesaling? Like, are people doing kind of like the same way that they were doing wholesaling right now, or how was it before?
Yeah, so 2017, YouTube University wasn't like what it is today. You know, what everybody knows today, like Pace, Jamil, all these guys, the Clever Investor, all that, they were around, but it wasn't like as prominent as it is today. So there was many courses, there wasn't as much stuff like today is bombarding you every day. Instagram wasn't as big. I know that there were some guys around at the time that were doing stuff and education, like, you know, that's been around since the 90s. But no, it wasn't as prevalent as it is today, where it's everywhere. And it seems like everybody has a course or something today.
So was it more challenging? Where do you feel like you had a lot of challenges at the beginning?
Listen, starting a business from scratch is always challenging, especially when you have no money. But it was definitely, I would say, and I sound old now because I see these new guys coming up and they have access to all this information. PropStream wasn't around. I mean, I can go on and on and on. Texting was a thing. Cold call centers weren't that big. You know, so things like that, they weren't around. So, yeah, it was more like you had to kind of figure stuff out on your own. Locally, and you know, the way I did it was find a mentor, right, locally, and that's just kind of how I got into it. But I didn't have, we didn't have the access to the amount of information as you do today. Where even like these podcasts where, you know, you can start a podcast out of nowhere. That was not as big as it was, back in the day. It just wasn't that the information just wasn't there. You know, you had to do more digging.
Yeah.
And you definitely figured it out the hard way.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Right now, you're still operating the business, and obviously, you are going into the education portion of it.
Yeah.
Who do you feel like really would get a lot from you? Because it seems like you can tailor to two different type of audiences, but within the U.S.
Yeah.
And these people obviously are going to get the nuggets from your operational side, your number side.
Sure.
I'm going to dig into that a little bit more, but like, who are you helping right now?
Yeah. So it's either people that are just starting out, where I do have a course and all that, and I'm building a community for that. So if you're at zero deals or you really haven't done a deal yet, which is fine, there's that side. And then I really enjoy and thrive off of the scaling side. More people that have done maybe 5 deals, 10 deals, give or take, they have some understanding of systems, very minimal ops. They're usually 1 or 2 man bands or women, right? And they're looking to make this more of a business and consistent, not just one deal, 1 month, 0 deals for the next 3 months, and 2 deals, you know, that roller coaster. So that's really where I focus a lot of my time. I still do run a very high volume wholesale operation, fix and flip and all that. So the education just kind of falls, and it works hand in hand, because the difference, I would say, between me and a lot of other educators, which there's no right or wrong, but a lot of people in the education side have kind of checked out of the day-to-day, which is fine, or they're just, they had a certain level of success and now they want to teach it. And now that's their full focus. Whereas I'm still in the day-to-day, you know, I have a team and all that, but I'm rolling with the economy, like this market shift, like I'm actually experiencing it real time. So what I pivot, what I teach, what I do, like innovations and all that, which we can get into, those are strategies that come out on, you know, off the cuff as the market shifts. So, you know, I went through COVID on my own, you know, with my partner. So we went through that. So I've been doing this. I wouldn't say that I've been doing this for 20 years because I haven't, but I've certainly been through a lot already from 2017, and you know, all the mistakes and pitfalls and stuff like that you get from actually operating.
Yeah, like you said, a lot of educators right now, they go full education after maybe hitting a first million or like maybe a first couple million, and then they don't consistently hold that wholesaling company, because if you think about it, wholesaling companies is hard to like get rid, you know, get out of that cap of that ceiling of maybe 3 million, 5 million, it, you know, to scale past that, it's much harder. It has a cap for the average wholesaler.
Yeah.
And you were able to get to 7 million. I'm pretty sure you can even go higher if you scale your operations.
Sure.
Talking about numbers, mm-hmm. You send us in the WhatsApp, you know how like men usually I just brag about like, oh, look, these are all the Tinder matches that I have. But instead, what you said was, these are all the flips that I'm doing. So you said 9.
Yeah.
And there were only the flips. Like there were only flips here locally in Miami. So what else is there? Like, what are you doing? Like so many flips doing at the same time?
Yeah. So I actually went yesterday with Juan and I at one of the properties with my girlfriend. And, you know, we met all his students and stuff like that, which was cool. And I kind of gave him a rundown and I answered a lot of questions. I enjoy it. You know, I enjoy what I do. But yeah, those were 9 flips or wholesales or, you know, just buy and relist and stuff like that. Some of them are full rehab. Some of them aren't. There's probably another 17 deals behind that are wholesales at any given time. You know, anywhere from 10 to 15-ish is my average per month. Even in this economy, and you know, a lot of innovations. I have a lot of JV deals too, which I didn't mention because I don't feel the need to. But yeah, there's a lot more to it than that. And you know, I just sent him the addresses and I said, let me know if these work for you.
Yeah. So you guys walk through one of your flips or yeah. One of your hotels.
Yeah.
So what's your goal on like flipping for this market with this 2023? we're feeling the recession. In terms of flips, like what's going on with the flips? What's going on with that? Like, should people keep doing that? Should people focus on more innovations?
Look, everybody is the best answer for that is everybody has a different goal. You know, I know guys that only buy and hold. So for them, it's going to make more sense, even in this economy. I think that there's probably going to be more opportunities within the next year or two. I don't think we're out of the woods yet. You know, the Fed is kind of slowing down with the rate hikes and all that, and inflation seems to be a little bit under control. But I think that we're still headed for much more opportunity. But I would say where I'm staying is within the FHA guidelines. So I'm flipping properties that are going to be sub 450 with ARB. So if you can stay there, all those properties that I currently have are still moving very, I would say, pretty competitively. With that being said, I have some flips that are above the 500K mark listed, especially one that was listed for 850, which we bought very right. We bought at 570. But we ended up selling it for 790. Yeah. Now, we still made a profit, but it was 60K swing off of what we thought we were going to make. And that was this month. So that's real time what's actually happening. So I think that you get hurt more the higher up you go because there's less buyers. So I would stick to wholesaling right now, figure out how to do novations. Sub twos is a great thing. I do a lot of sub twos. I love sub twos. But yeah, you have to be a little bit more creative now. And if you can stay below that 400, and if you can find stuff for 300 and below, you're going to move your inventory. There's not going to be a problem.
I also feel like you're talking that people need to start developing more recession-proof skills.
Yes.
Like 100% recession-proof, because it doesn't matter if wholesaling works and all will always continue working. You can wholesale car, you can wholesale shoes, whatever, right? It always will be a model that works. But what happens when it doesn't fit? Like, what happens if when the opportunity comes and opportunity doesn't fit that wholesale model? I've been a huge advocate on that ever since I started inbound marketing, because you don't know what type of homeowner is looking to sell their house. Let's say it's a $400,000 house, but they are in such a hurry of selling, but the house is like almost impeccable, or it doesn't need much, but like it's such a motivated seller. A wholesaler will never be able to like truly help that person if they don't acquire those recession-proof skills.
Correct.
So that's why you tell me.
Yeah. So I think that, I know for a fact, wholesaling was amazing. I can only speak to South Florida, but a lot of my friends that are nationwide in my masterminds, wholesaling is great when the economy is going great. So what's going to happen here is for the last 2 years, everybody got used to, and specifically in South Florida, 30, 40, 50K assignments were the norm. I'm one of the biggest benefactors of that, and I love it, right? I rode a very nice train for 2 years. With that being said, wholesale fees are going to get tighter. They're going to get smaller. That's what happens in a normal market, which we're heading towards a normalized market. Keep in mind what happened in the last 2 years is absurd. Okay. We printed a shit ton of money and values 50%, 100% appreciated over the last 2 years. So think about what I just said. That is not normal. So if your market corrects by 20 to 30%, let's say, but you appreciated over the last 2 years by 70%, you're still up, you know? But the days of only being, and this is what I'll say to anyone listening, if all you know how to do is submit a cash offer and try to sell to an investor, you are going to be screwed because you just pigeonholed yourself. So I would say get comfortable with doing novations, doing sub twos, and a little bit more creative. Deals are not going to be as easy as just submit a cash offer, get the wholesale deal, and wholesale it out to an investor. So that's what everybody, you know, it's the easiest thing to do. It's the lowest barrier to entry, probably what everybody teaches. But you, if you really want to thrive in whatever economy, you need to have more than one trick in the bag. That's for sure.
Were you? Do you learn sub twos or novations recently, or was it a thing that,
no.
that you?
So novations, I started doing them probably a year and a half ago. My boy, shout out to Eric Brewer, the beast. He is a king of novations. He taught me how to do them, so it's amazing. I bought his program, and you know, he's been a friend of mine for years. But subject twos, I did my first subject two accidentally almost 5 years ago. And then from there, I kind of learned how to do that. And any, I just did one the other week, which is a great subject two in Miami Lakes. And we bought the deed for $6,000. There's a mortgage for 410, and we're selling it for 650, subject to the mortgage. The ARV is like 900. So deals like that, if you would have wholesaled it, or if you would have approached that as a cash offer, you probably wouldn't have done that deal.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by being creative. And as a real estate investor, that's what you are anyway. And I think a lot of people tend to forget that. Maybe I sound a little old because I've been doing this for a while, but you really are a problem solver. And you're a transaction engineer. I had a mentor that told me that years ago, and that always stuck with me. You're a transaction engineer. Every transaction needs to be engineered in a different fashion. And the cash offer is obviously, it's easy. It's great when it works. You know, sometimes you can make 10K. Sometimes you can make 100K off assignments. I've done all of them, which is great. But sometimes there's not there. It's just not there to be done. So a novation can turn a dead lead into a 20K opportunity, a 30K opportunity. So who doesn't want to do that? And if you look at your CRM, so like one thing, when I started looking at my CRM with, we have about 16,000 leads in our CRM because we do a lot of marketing, like all time. And if you look at it, probably in our business, we focus like for wholesaling, you're going to get probably 5% of the population to be able to do business with you that will accept a cash offer and it's wholesalable. So think about that. That's 5% out of my 16,000 leads, right? But novations and sub twos and all these other strategies, primarily novations for the sake of this conversation, you can do that with almost anybody. So you have way more. There's millions sitting in my CRM just by shifting the perspective of how you view a transaction. So that's what I would tell people to do. You need to just, you really need to educate yourself. And when an economy shifts like this, everybody, you know, a rising tide floats all, raises all boats, whatever that expression is. But we're not in a rising tide anymore. So again, you really need to take, if you do want to be in this business, you want to thrive, survive, whatever you want to call it, you need to take the education aspect of it very seriously. And one thing, I'm not tooting my own horn, but one thing I've done for the last 6 years is always try to learn from people. I've always paid for masterminds. I've been in masterminds and I've put in the time. So I've just learned. I've been curious. Curiosity as an entrepreneur is probably one of your best skill sets that you can have, because believe it or not, I did $7 million in revenue, but I didn't know how to really do novations, you know? That's saying something, right? And I tend to think doing 150 transactions a year, I would kind of know what I'm talking about, right? So I think I'm hot shit. And then all of a sudden I hear about novation. I'm like, what is this shit? And I learn and I'm like, wow. You know, I could have had a $10 million a year if I'd have applied this. That's a fact. So when you look at it that way, you're like, damn, you never stop learning.
You know? Yeah. So you have 16,000 leads sitting in the CRM. And you have this opportunity of the skill set that you have now acquired. Your team is learning it too. What are you going to do with those leads?
I'm going to try to close every single one.
So what's the strategy behind there?
Yeah, so one of the simplest, easiest ways that you can make a ton of money, right? If you have a CRM, and I don't care whether you have 500 leads, 100 leads, or 16,000, right? I have friends that have 30, 40,000. I don't care how many you have, but a very easy way to get into profitability is remarketing to that CRM as a cold lead, texting, cold calling, and just do a once over again through all that CRM. And what you're looking for is as you grow and as you scale, you've had so many conversations, your team has had so many conversations that things get, you know, things fall through the cracks, things get forgotten. A conversation that I had with, you know, that my team had with a seller 3 months ago, it's in the notes, but they're so inundated with new leads and this and that. By the way, your team is usually going to focus on low hanging fruit. They're not going to really remember 3 months ago, but that 3 months ago that was at 400 will probably be at 320 today, 3 months later, especially now that the market has shifted. So just doing a once over, what you're trying to do is, hey, out of all these leads, I'm trying to get the cream to rise to the top. And can I capture an opportunity? Great. And let me not drop the ball there. So you should be consistently doing that. Probably once a month, give or take, maybe once every 2 months. But you should, the, as cliche as it sounds, I'm sure a lot of people have heard this, the fortune's in the follow-up. It really is in the follow-up. The bulk of your business is going to be done on follow-up.
So literally, we're going to grab every single contact and we're going to be doing a reoffer campaign.
Correct.
And that would add a couple of deals because like they're there every single month. So you grab all the contact and do they plug it into like a some sort of software like Launch Control?
Yeah, you could do Launch Control and just whatever cold calling software you're using. If you're a one man or one woman band, cold call them, all of them. Pop it into a triple line dialer, cold call them all. It doesn't matter. You're looking to re-spark a conversation. And you already, think about it. Number one, I've already paid for all these leads. Number one. I've already logged in that expense. Number two, I have more information than a cold conversation. So I can reference that conversation as I see fit, whatever is in the notes. And number three, they've already raised their hand at one stage or another, whether it was 6 months ago, a week ago, 2 months ago, it doesn't matter. They've said yes, because they are in your CRM.
Yeah.
So these people have already raised their hand and to some degree, I don't know what the motivation is, everybody's different, but they've said, I am interested in selling. I am interested in talking about selling my product.
Yeah.
So you should be talking to those people first before you're going out and generating cold leads. You know, ideally you should be doing both.
Yeah, love it. We actually implement a monthly reoffer or a reactivation campaign. It's kind of the same thing, remarketing, reactivation, reoffer. Where we have a workflow that if, you know, let's say we're telling our clients, hey, I was testing something new that might be helping you, for example, sell your property at a, let's say for novations, at a full price or get full price for your home. And we also buy cash. So if you are interested and, you know, just reply to me this or that. You can go further into the offer, but you're remarketing and reoffering to these people about a new opportunity that you had and with a marketing message where you spark their interest once again, curiosity, and maybe add some urgency or scarcity there. Then you can get people to reply. You get them back into the phone call and you can create fancy workflows where like if they reply positively, that automatically notifications, maybe a text message saying, awesome, great, what's the best time to like talk to you about it? Here's my calendar, but give me 5 minutes and I'll give you a call. Mm-hmm. Something like that. And then if you have an email, you could also re-email to them. So we do that now monthly and it's been helping us add at least 1 to 2 deals extra per month. Easy. And they, like you said, like you go reference in the stuff, in the stuff that has happened in the past, in the conversation. And, you know, it's just much better lead. It's a lead that doesn't cost you much.
And here's the deal. Most people aren't doing this. So one statistic, the average sale happens just at industry standard, but the average sale happens with 6 to 8 touches. Okay. Touches meaning how many times it took you to get this person.
You're not going to touch the homeowner.
No, let's not do that because that's harassment. So we might not want to do that. I'm definitely not saying that. But 6 to 8 touches, right? Meaning contacts and conversations that you've had, moving that lead from new lead all the way down to a converted contract. Mm-hmm. The average salesperson, okay, the top 1% of salespeople in the sales industry in general, do the best of us, do 2 to 3 touches and follow-ups, then they move on. So if I'm telling you that it takes 6 to 8 to do that, and most people are only doing, the best people are only doing 2 to 3, and if you go above and beyond, and maybe you set a new expectation, say, I'm going to touch every single lead 10 different times. Well, over time, you are going to win every single time. And I was teaching this to my girlfriend the other day because she's in the real estate business too. I'm like, the more persistent and consistent that you are with anybody, whether it's a deal from the MLS or an off-market deal, it doesn't matter. Over time, you're going to win.
Yeah.
You're going to win because most people are moving on. And we all, you know, the human mind tells ourselves this bullshit story of like, well, I've tried calling 3 times. They just don't want to sell. No, you just didn't try hard enough. You weren't consistent enough for long enough of the time. And what's going to happen is, ask me how I know. When you go back to last year's deals, and let's say all the ones, if I went through all my CRM and I looked at everybody that didn't want to sell, dude, it's going to be millions of dollars in revenue that other wholesalers close or other fix and flippers close, or an Ovation could have been done. Yeah. That's a fact, because these people are going to convert. You just have to do the best job at being there when it happens. Yeah. And you can't catch them all. This isn't Pokemon, but you can increase your chances, especially if you're newer. That's a superpower that you can use that doesn't require more money. All it requires is more effort, consistency on a calendar to set up reminders and follow-ups is very simple, and it's just extra hustle and it's free. So if I could say anything to anyone right now, like, hey, I'm not getting deals, go back to your CRM. Make sure you stay real sticky with your leads, because the stickier you are, the more profitable you're going to be.
Be hungry and like consistent with what you already have. If you're hungry enough that you know that you're going to work that lead, don't stop until they literally tell you fuck off.
Mm-hmm.
Or like even that, you can still continue 3 months after or something like that. Like,
yeah.
You're like, hey man, like at some point you told us you needed to sell. Yeah. How are you doing that? Were you able to get help?
Yeah, 100%. It's just, again, don't ever let, one of the mistakes that I made scaling my company was that I put myself into the seller's shoes and I started making my own ideas of what they wanted or what they were going to do. So don't ever let the past reflect what the future can be.
Oh yeah.
Because somebody told me to fuck off 3 months ago, I can almost guarantee you 3 months down the line, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, it could be a year, I don't know, they're going to convert. They're going to change. That problem eventually is going to run its course. And now they have to make a move. I can't tell you how many deals I get where people are like, yeah, you know, I've been thinking about selling for like about a year, but I'm ready now. I was just the guy there.
Yeah.
You know, the more consistent you are, the luckier you get.
I got a question. So yeah. you're doing a lot of stuff in South Florida, Miami.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that it's also one of the toughest markets too. So how do you deal with like being, what's the difference between Miami market compared to, let's say, other markets in Florida or the United States? Because the reason why I ask is because a lot of people that have money from South America, Latin America, they want to buy in Miami, right? They come here and they're so used to buying cash, putting cash into their countries. They don't know all these tricks. They don't know that they can do sub twos. They don't know they can do seller finance. They don't know that they can do like novations. We're not used to being creative in the financing because we're so used to giving cash, right? Because like financing in our country is crazy. Like
you just don't do it. Debt is really bad in South America or the Hispanic culture as a whole.
Yeah.
Debt is bad. And I think first of all, it's bullshit. I've had to, you know, I was raised, you're American, I'm first generation. My family did the best that they could, but their ideas on money and my ideas on money are very different.
Yes.
I'd had to reprogram my financial blueprint where, you know, I grew up with a single mom that, you know, bless her heart, she actually flipped real estate too. But she always taught me like, save your money. And, you know, as I got older and as I got into this business, and I started learning from wealthy people, real wealthy people, they're like, what are you saving your money for? You're saving your money to make an investment. You're not saving your money just to have it in the bank. And debt is not bad. It depends on what kind of debt. Credit card for stupid shit. Credit card debt for stupid shit, bad debt. Leveraging on a house to buy a rental so you can buy two or three at a time, great debt. Those are different things. Taking on debt to scale your company when you know that it's successful already and you have a proven track record, good debt. It's that, those are the differences. Now going and financing a $200,000 car because you want to look like a baller, stupid debt, bad debt. And you know, there's a lot of that going around. I've spent money on stupid shit too, but it's just, Miami's competitive. South Florida's competitive. Look, any market is really competitive. I don't really like to think of that. Since 2017, everyone and their mother told me, even back then, imagine in 2017, what I heard getting into the game, what I always heard was, oh, bro, this is super competitive. Oh, bro, it's almost impossible to find deals in Miami. Oh, dude, the market's so high right now. Oh, man, it's so hot. Dude, I heard that in 2017. We know what's happened since then. Imagine. And I was buying houses in Miami Gardens back then for $150, $170, three twos. Okay. Houses that today you'd be lucky to get at 300. So who was competitive? You know, I didn't really listen to it because I had no option. So I just went for it and I just stayed consistent. Competition is going to be anywhere. The more consistent and the better you are at something and providing a better service and or being more consistent or more professional, knowing your shit better than the next guy, you're always going to do well.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
So let's say someone that recently came from Cuba, Colombia, Venezuela, here, there in Miami, South Florida, yeah, Argentina, whatever, and they're looking to get into real estate. And obviously, like, they come in with, I want to buy houses. I want to flip homes.
Sure.
This looks so great. I have the cash, whatever. But really, the market right now going on in the next 2 years and everything, what's the best steps to actually start here in Miami? Where should they probably look at in the single family route, maybe two units, three units, you know, just small residential. Like, how can you get started? How can they actually start creating a substantial real estate investing business?
Well, listen, I'm gonna come out and say it. You can hit me up. I do coach, I do mentorship in English and Spanish. So finding a mentor that is in that area is a great way to do it. So I offer services like that. I work with a lot of international people. I'm fluent in Spanish, so I can explain it in both languages, which is one of my competitive advantages. And in Miami, I've been doing business for the last 6 years. 40-50% of my business has been all in Spanish. If I didn't speak Spanish, I'd be fucked. Yeah. I wouldn't have done 7 million. I guarantee. I would have maybe done, you know, 3.
Tell me more about that. So, like, you get a lot of sellers, homeowners that speak only Spanish, or what? Mm-hmm. So if you don't know Spanish, then it gets challenging.
It gets really challenging. So, you know, you would probably want to pivot and partner with somebody or joint venture with somebody, right, like me, you know, that speaks Spanish. And, you know, I'm really, not because my name is Will, but, like, really, where there's a will, there's a way. No pun intended, but seriously, if you want to figure something out, I'm a firm believer you're going to figure it out. I don't take no as an answer. I just figure it out. You know, I've had sellers that are German, sellers that are Haitian, that I don't speak Creole, right? I understand French, but I don't speak Creole. I figured it out. I bring in a person who is Haitian to work with them. So that's where your network comes into play, and how the more successful you're going to be in this business, it's going to depend on how resourceful you are.
Yeah. Are Latino homeowners more sketched about this wholesaling thing? Are they, like, more sketched about, like, that's a scam? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, I certainly don't approach people saying, hey, I'm going to wholesale your house. You know, I think that's an easy way to screw that up. But yeah, of course, Latinos are, you know, we're typically more like, you know, we come from countries where people have fucked people over. And it's kind of like, I see you, man. You know what I mean? Like, Cubans, I'm Cuban. My grandma's like, no, I don't like that guy. You know, that kind of stuff. And that's fine. But again, it's just, it's a cultural thing. If you speak Spanish and you can understand them, that's a trust factor right there. That barrier is already broken down. And as long as you do business the right way, you're ethical, you're upfront, and you perform on what you say you're going to perform, you shouldn't have a problem.
You know? So is your team bilingual? Mm-hmm. Like, entire team?
I would say, with the exception of some VAs, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where you got it? Like, where are your VAs from? Philippines?
Yeah, so I have Filipino VAs. I have Colombian VAs, Nicaraguan VAs. I think I have one VA in India, but they're like data.
Yeah.
Because they're very, very good. But yeah, I have a VA company that it's like really my own company that I source my own VAs for my own company. So now I'm starting to, you know, turn that into a business where other people can come and get a VA from us. But yeah, cold callers, all of them. I mean, listen, I built out a really big ass in-house team, and to be honest, my VAs probably kick their ass any day of the week. And then now I've switched more to a virtual model. They just work harder. They work better. And anybody that's on your team, it just goes back to systems, processes, SOPs, and how you define. So if you don't have a process predefined in your business, guess what's going to happen when you hire somebody? They're going to fucking invent their own process.
Yeah.
Now that's a problem.
Yeah.
So make sure that you document, especially, I wish I would have done it very early on when I was a one, two man band, little by little, little by little. See, when you're small, you think that, oh, well, I don't need to write this stuff down because it's not going to matter when I scale. No, it is going to matter. When you're small, it's very controllable. It's very, like when you make a decision or when you make a pivot, it's immediate. When you got a 20-person team and you want to change the process, that's a problem. Because now you got to get everybody on the same boat. And it's harder. It takes more time. When you want to pivot marketing and you're spending 100K a month, that's not easy. As opposed to, hey, I'm spending 5K a month. Very easy switch. Hey, I want to switch my CRM. Try switching your CRM when you have 300 leads and you're a one-man band. And then try it when you have a 20-person team with 16,000 leads.
I cannot imagine.
Disaster.
Did you do that?
Yeah, I did that. And I built out Salesforce. And Salesforce is a pain in my ass. Still, $150,000 later in the custom build-out.
God damn.
Yeah. And I kind of miss Podio, to be honest. Even though I'm not a big fan of Podio, because as you grow, it's the servers and stuff like that, it's not the best. But man, let me tell you, I think I have a lot of students that are like, hey, I want to get in Salesforce. I'm like, you don't. Yeah. You have no idea what you're talking about. Stay one thing in business, especially when you're smaller, simple is better. Simple is better. You do not need shiny whistles and bells and shit like that. You don't. Trust me, I tried it. You're just going to burn money and you're just going to overcomplicate the system. Yeah. Stick to the basics, dribbling, to use a basketball analogy, dribbling, the hook shot, the free throws, and just shooting. That's it. Just stick to the basics, man. Rebounding. Like, that's really what you need to do.
Love that. Super simple. Yeah. So how's your team looking like right now?
We have about, I think we're like 14 or 15 right now.
Okay.
Is where we're at, mostly virtual.
And if we were to like see the departments, the operations, like how are they distributed?
So there's marketing, there's data, there's acquisition, there's disposition, vision, which is me at the top, the CEO. There's accounting, which is like a floating CFO that we have. There's a rehab project management seat as well. I don't have a project manager anymore. That was a whole nother story, but we're not doing as many rehabs as we once were. So again, for me,
I mean, 9 right now,
but they're not rehabs.
Gotcha.
Most of them are not rehabs. I would say out of those 9, maybe 3 were full rehabs where I fully decked them out, the whole 9, right? 40 grand into the house, kitchen back.
Just wholesale.
Paint patch, wholesale. Or, hey, I literally closed and I relisted it the next day because I got a good price on them. Or subject to, I'm not renovating. Or innovation. But yeah, no. I've done a lot of rehab. Rehab is not my forte.
Yeah.
I'll be the first to admit it. I hate rehab.
Yeah.
Can't stand them.
So in the marketing, what marketing are you doing?
Cold calling, direct mail, and texting.
Okay.
Again, keep it simple. Love that. I've tried PPC, not to say that it doesn't work. I got friends that spend 100K a month in PPC. They do great. Just direct mail, cold calling, texting. That's it. And the best marketing that I've found is consistency.
I like that. I like that answer.
It is. I mean, people try to overcomplicate shit. I'll go back to this because it's lessons that I've learned. Consistency. I used to think that the right answer for making more money was spending more money.
Mm-hmm.
That's a common flaw, mistake, whatever. I'd be the first to admit it. Spending more money doesn't necessarily mean, but actually most of the time, spending more money is not your problem or having more capital. It's being more efficient, following up more, and converting higher. That's really where your issues are. So less is more. You can do a lot. Like, I've already had 16,000 leads in the CRM. Like, there's millions sitting in there. Like, what happens to them? Let's go through them, right? And of course, new leads are the lifeblood of your business. I get it. You want to continue to market, but as you're smaller, don't just throttle down because you're like, oh, these leads suck. I need new leads. That's a common thing I see where people are like, oh yeah, these 400 leads suck. No one wants to sell there. I need another 100 leads. I'm like, what? No. Let's really go through the 400. Let's see. And I can pick off deals left and right. I guarantee it. And then they see it and they're like, oh my God. And you're talking about when you're smaller, you could find an extra 100K, an extra 200K. An extra 300K. What's that worth to you? Right? In stuff you've already done. This is effort you've already put in. This is money you've already spent. Systems, process, they're already there. Focus on that. Why go to the new thing? So that's what I've learned over the years.
So if someone comes in and they take your educational program, mm-hmm. What should they expect? What can you help them on? Because I heard that you also even help them get their VA ramped up, essentially. Like kind of go through the entire training or learning curve. So I'm just curious, like, what are you thinking about doing for both English and Spanish community to help them operate a business?
Yeah. So I have different tiers of students that come to me. I'll give you an example. I have some students that have money that have been successful in another business, whatever it is, and they want to get into wholesaling. And they've approached me and said, hey, I'm not broke. I don't need this whole sweat equity thing, which is cool. I have XYZ money. I'd like to pay you to build out my systems, my business. And I say, okay, cool. That's a very high ticket item because it's time consuming for me, but I built out my business like a McDonald's, right? So everything is systemized and processed and it's documented. So I charge them, that's a higher ticket item. And then I have other students that come to me that probably my favorite, I would say, that are already doing maybe a deal a month, a deal here, a deal there. Maybe they have 10 deals under their belt. They got a little bit of money. They just need somebody there every month for accountability. You know, an hour or two a week running deals by me seeing a deal, and then they bring it to me and I maximize that deal. What they thought was 20K is really 50K by know-how, right, and experience. They leverage my network, my attorney, my buyer's list, my lenders, et cetera, and my experience. So those are more a middle tier. And then there's the beginning tier, which is, buy my course, which I made an English and Spanish one, which is literally a course from zero, like never done a deal, to your first deal. And then how to rinse and repeat that. And then typically those students scale up. Like they stack up to, once they do that and they become a little bit successful, then they move up the ladder to, hey, I want more one-on-one and I want to scale now. And then they just keep jumping.
That's awesome. So how are you helping with the VAs right now? I'm curious.
Yeah. So again, it's not like a big venture for me, but I have so many VAs in my team that I can easily source more and more VAs. And my two VAs on my team that are like my head VAs that have been with me for 4+ years, Don and Liddell, they're amazing. And they know every single system, process, training, everything.
Where are they from? Philippines?
They're from the Philippines. Yeah, they're amazing. And they can train other, like if you came to me and you wanted VAs to run comps, to pull lists, to do data stacking, to send out contracts. I mean, we can name 100 different things here, right? My VAs can train them for you. And then they'll just plug and play.
Yeah.
For texting, for cold calling, et cetera. So that's how I'm helping people in that regard.
Yeah, we're trying to actually partner up with people that have a system to train virtual assistants or just people in general pretty quickly, pretty effectively, mm-hmm. Because we can source hundreds of VAs per month. And we get like over 1,000 applications every single month, man. And we run ads to actually like get virtual assistants from Latin America and things like that from every single position. So there might be an opportunity there to just have a chat where, because we are remote Latinos, right? And we want to help the entire Latin American virtual assistant community to get jobs and careers in the US. Now, it doesn't have to be in Latin America. We still get amazing Filipinos, amazing people from Asia, Africa, South Africa. Like, man, there's a lot of talent around the world. Yeah. But obviously, I am Latin American. My partner lives in Colombia. Sure. So I have I have a great passion about helping on that regard.
Yeah.
And so if anyone actually looks for a virtual assistant, someone comes to us, but they don't necessarily come in trained.
Mm.
So that's when a strategic person that would help us do that. And, it will even package the offer even better.
Sure.
Because imagine Juan right now is helping our acquisition VAs getting ramped up with sales training, conversion. So there's a huge opportunity for remote work to you know, virtual assistants to do all these remote jobs that you can do as a closer, as a setter, as a appointment setter, lead manager, follow-up specialist, data analyst, data manager,
yeah,
and whatever. And they can scale a company like you're doing with a few virtual assistants. But I feel like you also have for people in-house as well, right? Okay.
I think I have two in-house people right now.
Okay.
One of them is my TC and one of them is an acquisition rep that's been with me for a long time. He's great.
How many acquisitions you got?
Total five.
And four of those acquisitions, are they outside of the US?
Mm-hmm.
No way.
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
No.
Awesome.
No, I'm not.
I like people to tell me this because we can
do it. I will be the first person to tell you that if you took away everything right now and I started again, I would go hire three VAs and myself, and I would make $1 million net inside 365 days, like that, in South Florida. And as a matter of fact, I'm kind of, I'll just allude to this. I'm kind of doing that on my own right now as like an experiment.
Oh,
just like a little challenge to myself.
Uncover,
undercover billionaire or whatever, or undercover boss, whatever that shit is.
Yeah, yeah.
But seriously, and I, because one day I got so sick of hearing
undercover
people,
Tony Montana.
So sick and tired of hearing people bitching and moaning and, oh my God, it's so hard. And what do I do? Dude, I was just like, this can't be, man. He's like, this is bullshit. And so I just said to myself, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this shit from scratch again. And let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And, no doubt about it. No, you do not need in-house people. First of all, I made my first seven figures in this business, my business partner and I. There was nobody else. We didn't even have a fucking VA. So we cleared $1 million in gross revenue, just a two-man band. So do not tell me that it can't be done, because it can. And then the next year, it was two of us and two virtual assistants, and we did 1.6. So no, it can absolutely be done. It's just, how focused are you with your time and how consistent are you and how much are you hustling? That's all it is.
Love that.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to dive in a little bit more into like your Willie Numbers name.
Sure.
Because they call you for a reason. I know you were in finance and everything and stuff like that, yeah. But you must be tracking your metrics, your KPIs, and you must be teaching this to your leaders of your company,
mm-hmm,
how to properly do this. So if you were to tell me, Esteban, I'm in your company and I see a disaster because these numbers don't make sense, you're not tracking those numbers, what would be those first things that you point out?
So I'm a big KPI guy. That's no secret. It depends on what size the organization is. Let me just backtrack here for a second. People, one mistake I've seen and I've done it in my past, people track like 30 KPIs. People over-track KPIs. Example, direct mail, right? Everybody is so freaking hot on, well, what's your response rate? What's your response rate? What's your response rate? And I hear that shit all the time. I've been hearing it for years. For me, I used to track response rate. Do I track it? Yeah. But it's a sub, it's kind of like a, it's like a counter indicator of what I'm really tracking, which is ROI. I'm tracking ROI on direct mail. Why? If I spend 50K a month in direct mail, but it's generating me 200K a month, do you think I give a shit what my response rate is? I do not care. But if I was to look at my response rate spending 50K, I would be like, damn, it's less than 1%. This marketing channel doesn't work. That's a mistake that people make. They base their marketing based off of the response. Now, of course, it is important. You have to get the phone to ring in order to convert. But if I'm generating 200K a month in revenue from 50K in, it's a 4X return. Would you do that?
Of course.
You would put 50, you would put 100K.
Response rate becomes a vanity metric at that point.
Correct. It is. It's a loss leader. I don't care. You know, big corporations do that all the time where they have something that they sell you because they know that you're going to buy something else. They lose money on this one, but they make double the money over there. It's called a loss leader. So I would definitely track, again, are you talking about somebody beginning or?
Let's say it's someone that is doing five deals a month.
Five deals a month. So what I would basically be tracking is cost per deal, cost per contract. Those are two different metrics, by the way. So cost per deal is how much did I spend? So cost per contract, let me start with cost per contract. So cost per contract is your marketing cost, and then how many, let's say you spend, for the sake of simple numbers, you spend 10K this month and you got four contracts. Okay. So your cost per contract was 2,500 bucks. You follow me?
Yep.
But realistically, we have about a 30%, 40% fallout ratio. So 30% of the deals that we get under contract aren't going to close for a number of reasons, title issues, whatever. So let's just say that out of the four, you close three. Well, now your cost per deal is 3,300 bucks with 33 cents, whatever, if you're really rounding up. So those are two very important metrics to track. Okay. Then the amount of calls, so outbound dials, conversations that you're having. And then the biggest indicator that I would track across the board, it's called a brick. It's my brick in my business, is offers made. Offers made is by far, especially when you're small or when you're like a one-man band, dude, offers made is by far the most important. I cannot stress this enough. It's by far the most important metric that you need to track. If you track nothing else, you just track the offers made, you're going to be okay. And the reason I say that is because, number one, you can't get anything under contract that you don't make an offer on. Yeah. Number two, you should be making an offer on fucking everything. And I mean that literally, on everything. Because the more people you talk to and the more offers you make, the more offers you have that are going to be accepted. And then you work the problem backwards. So offers made is by far the most important metric.
Love that.
And then, you know, of course, sub KPIs and stuff like that. If you're doing five deals a month, let's say for the sake of argument, simple numbers, 20K, right? A deal. Dude, you should be reinvesting at least 50% of that. At least 50% of that to scale. And at five deals a month, that's a pretty solid operation. That's 60 deals a year. You don't need many people to do that at all. You really don't. And that's a $1.2 million business right there.
Yeah. What's the best way to actually track that, man? Like, a lot of people feel, I think that they start like playing with spreadsheets and things like that, but then they get stuck.
The best way to track that is daily.
Okay.
To avoid bullshit and avoid forgetting it.
Yeah.
So anything you can track daily is great. So a simple little spreadsheet. I have KPI spreadsheet. I mean, I have so many, I don't even know what to do with them, but they've changed over the years, right? But I have one little spreadsheet that at this point my VAs fill in. They get it from all the acquisition reps and the dispo reps and all that, and they just fill in the buckets every day. At the end of the shift every day. And they say, hey, how many offers? Hey, I made three offers today. I made two offers today. Okay, cool. So we've got seven offers made today. How many conversations do we have? We had, you know, collectively 100 conversations today. Okay, cool. So we're making 7% of what we're who we're talking to, we're making offers on.
Yeah.
Right? That's low. I'm already going to be upset at that. I'm going to be like, there's a problem. See how I'm viewing my KPIs? I'm like, that's going to be an issue. That's going to be an issue a month down the line. If we keep going at 7% rate, we're going to have a problem a month down the line.
Okay.
So that's the importance of tracking your KPIs. Your KPIs should be a little snapshot into looking at something day to day, week over week, month over month, quarter over quarter. And that's how you should be looking at it.
How do you keep yourself, well, obviously, since you're a number guy, but for people that are not used to looking at numbers, for people that are not used to checking their KPIs or even tracking, keeping themselves accountable on literally just putting those numbers, fitting in those numbers, and looking at those numbers.
Yeah. So again, keep it simple, stupid. I would make a repetitive, if you have an iPhone, so easy. Grab your iPhone, make a calendar reminder every day, repetitively, and put repeat daily at 5 p.m., let's say, or at 6 p.m., whatever. You shouldn't be stopping at 5 p.m. for the record if you're new. But 5 p.m., and it says, fill out KPIs. And you have to do, you fill them in, track five KPIs, like what I just mentioned, boom, boom, boom. And that's it. And at the end of every week, make another calendar reminder and say, review KPIs. And you look at them. Now, when you're new and you start tracking, give yourself about a month, 2 months, 3 months, really, ideally a quarter worth of data is awesome. Because when you're tracking KPIs, don't get discouraged at the beginning because you don't have enough data. You don't have enough of a data sample set. So a quarter is great. 90 days of consistent effort. If you're doing exactly what you say you're going to do, for example, if you're new, set up a metric for yourself. If you're like one person, you say, hey, I'm going to dial 600 people a day I'm going to send out 200 texts a day, and I'm going to make 5 offers a day every day for the next 90 days. Set that as a goal. Set those as your metrics. That's exactly what I would track. And I guarantee you, by the way, if you do that and you do that consistently for 90 freaking days, you will have success. And if you don't have deals by the end of that 90 days, call me because something went wrong. Yeah. But I guarantee if you put that level of dedication, effort, et cetera, no problem.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. It's that simple.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
It's crazy how simple it is, because it's also the key of continuously scaling your business past the cap where you're at, man.
And people think that, like, because I'm at where I'm at today, people are like, oh, man, yeah, but it's easy for you to say because, you know, you're here and whatever, and you got all these employees and stuff. Listen, it didn't start that way. It wasn't always the case. I did this over the years learning. And for 2 years, I didn't track shit because I didn't know. And the worst thing, you don't know what you don't know, until I got a mentor who told me. He was like, well, how many, you know, I was like, oh man, the business is sucking. This is years ago, but oh, we're not getting, you know, we're not getting contracts. We're not getting deals. You know, this is a problem. And simply put, he was like, how many people did you speak to? How many offers did you make? And how many market pieces did you send out? How many follow-ups did you do? That's another great KPI. And I was like, and I couldn't give him an answer.
Goddamn.
And he's like, that's the fucking problem. That's the problem. You have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
And by the way, when you're operating that way in business, you want to talk about having anxiety? That's an easy way to get anxiety.
Yeah.
And to do this in the business. Yeah. And that's why people that come to me for education or mentorship or coaching, whatever, they're like, oh man, I'm so stressed out. I'm so this, I'm so that. And I already know that without them saying a word, I'm like, okay, they're like that because they're not tracking anything. Because if you're tracking everything, and you have your KPIs. I'm not saying that stress and anxiety doesn't exist in business, because of course it does. But if you're tracking all that stuff, it calms you down, because you're like, okay, at least I know maybe we're having a bad month, maybe we're having a bad 2 months, but at least I know that the metrics are there. At least I know that the effort is there. So eventually we're going to be successful because we're putting up all the right effort there. But if you don't track it, you're like, well, I feel like I've been doing all this work. And it's like, yeah, you probably have been doing all this work, but you don't know how much of it you are actually doing.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Oh man, that's huge. Well, right now we've got already almost an hour, and yeah, it's awesome. But how can people actually search you or find you on social media or anywhere?
Yeah, so I'm on TikTok and Instagram. I'm very big on Instagram, Willie Numbers. So Willy Numbers, the word spelled out, plural, is my Instagram. You can DM me. I have a link tree there that has all my stuff, all my coaching, mentorship, courses, etc. If you want to JV with me, same thing. I JV with people all the time, meaning if you have a deal or something like that. And you know, if you want to get on a consulting call, that's also the case. I do a webinar every Tuesday at 6 p.m. with my buddy Henry Camejo, and we talk about Q&A. It's about 30 to 45 minutes every Tuesday. And you're probably going to see this podcast delayed, but there's a live event January 26th at the Alluvion, which is going to be like a 3-hour event. We're just going to be having a Q&A, a panel, myself speaking up there with Henry as well. And we're going to be doing that every single month. So it's the best way to contact me.
If I'm able to make it, I'll be there, man.
Yeah, absolutely. By all means, feel free to come.
All right. Well, man, thank you for being here in this podcast, dude. It was awesome. Like, we covered a bunch of different stuff. But if anyone is actually looking to connect with Willie, go to his Instagram, and man, like, he's a wealth of knowledge, and he literally is going to help you scale. Like, not many operators currently do that at a high level and teach this. There's only a few, and people need to know this guy. He speaks both Spanish and English. He's gonna help both communities. Like, goddamn, I cannot wait for this guy to actually explode.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for being part of the podcast. Again, if you found any value on the podcast, I want you to actually share it with everyone that you know. I want you to review it and tell us how we did in the episode and whether you got value or not. And yeah, just go on Apple, Spotify, and give us 5 stars if you like it. And if you don't like it, well, tell me why. But hope you have a great one. And this was an awesome episode of the Online Hustle Response.
I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, man.
Cool.